Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It says right there on the front of that dollar bill you've got in your wallet, legal tender for all debts, public and private. You can spend the greenback almost anywhere in the world, until the rest of the world says you can't. Today on the broadcast, the costs and benefits of owning the reserve currency. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by SunGard. SunGard Availability Services operates 5 million square feet of secure data center space dedicated to keeping people and information connected. More information at SunGard.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 6th of October, and it is great to have you here. The foreign exchange markets were abuzz today with what amounts to not much more than a rumor. A report in the UK newspaper The Independent that some Persian Gulf countries want to stop selling their oil for dollars. The dollar has been the oil market currency of choice for almost 40 years now, and even if the news does turn out not to be true, and we should say here it has been already denied by the Saudis, it does raise this question. What do you suppose would happen if, or maybe when, the dollar's no good anymore? Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports from New York.
There are obvious benefits to having the world do business with our currency. Here's one from Mark Chandler, global head of currency strategy at Brown Brothers Harriman and author of the book Making Sense of the Dollar.
We don't have to worry about the exchange rate so much. If the dollar weakens, the price of oil doesn't really go up for Americans.
And then there's the tricky issue of the trade deficit.
We run these huge trade deficits. And what that means is that we're not exporting enough products to pay for the products that we import.
Peter Schiff is president of Euro-Pacific Capital and author of Crash Proof 2.0. He says instead of making enough cars and computers to pay for our imports, we make dollars.
One of the main reasons that our trading partners will accept dollars for their products is because OPEC will accept those dollars for their oil.
And he says where oil goes, most other commodities follow. So if countries stop paying for oil in dollars, pretty soon the greenback would lose its status as the world's main reserve currency. Mark Chandler says that's a bunch of doom and gloom. He says the dollar's strength goes far deeper than an oil well. It's backed up by the power and stability of the United States and the dominance of U.S. capital markets.
I'm not completely closed to the idea that there could be an alternative down the road for the U.S. dollar. I just don't see it happening anytime soon.
Not least because what would the new oil currency be? China's yuan is still a baby on the world stage, and the euro only just turned 10. Chandler says there's really no other currency with the U.S. dollar's currency. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Currency, ba-doom, boom. But anyway, even if, as the chairman of the Fed himself says, the recession is over, it sure doesn't feel like it. Unemployment is still rising. Consumers are still gun-shy. So Democrats in Washington are talking about what else they can do to get the economy moving. Whatever you do, though, don't call it another stimulus plan. Marketplace's Steve Henn has the details.
The ideas include extending unemployment insurance and health benefits, continuing the federal government's big tax credits for first-time homebuyers, even giving employers a $3,000 tax credit for each new hire. But it's worth noting that close to $500 billion from the president's first stimulus package still hasn't been spent. More than $200 billion went to state governments and for tax credits. But when it comes to big projects,
only about $30 billion has actually been awarded to contractors.
Eric Gillespie tracks the stimulus at Recovery.com.
That doesn't actually mean $30 billion has been spent.
Once a contract is awarded, it takes a while to hire workers and get a project off the ground. Gillespie says there are literally hundreds of billions for renewable energy projects and health IT that haven't hit the economy yet. Still, Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research says the administration is right to want more.
They're looking at projections for unemployment that are really pretty dire.
The Congressional Budget Office predicts unemployment next year will average more than 10%.
We would ordinarily consider that horrible.
And as Democrats in Congress know, 2010 is an election year.
So they can't be satisfied with that prospect.
But any new spending's likely to raise some hackles on Capitol Hill. Republican lawmakers have been attacking the administration for reckless spending for months. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
On the topic of rising unemployment, there is a wave of layoffs sweeping through Hollywood. Just yesterday, Universal Pictures canned its top two executives. Last month, the longtime head of the Disney Studios got his walking papers. All three of them were replaced not by movie makers, but by marketers. Cynthia Littleton is the deputy editor of Daily Variety. Cynthia, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks.
How much of what's going on at the top of some of these studios is just the nature of the way Hollywood works, and then how much is sort of the recession really changing things?
You know, there's no question that this incredible double whammy of an executive shuffle that we saw at two of Hollywood's major film studios is driven in part by the recession and the general slowdown in consumer spending that we've seen over the past year. But it also really speaks to bigger structural fundamental changes that are happening in the entire show business arena, and it's really quite a dramatic reaction to that.
Enlighten me. Other than DVD sales falling off the cliff and us, you know, doing other things with our time, what else is going on?
Well, I think consumers doing other things with their leisure time and their entertainment dollars is a big issue. In a truly multi-platform, gazillion-channel world, it's just increasingly hard for movies to break through with the key younger audiences that they need to reach. And, you know, as people are also consuming movies and television show in different ways, they watch them on their computer. There's a growing video on demand market that is changing the, you know, fundamental economics of movies that used to start at the box office and then go through a couple of stops, pay TV, the home video window. And that was a pretty clear, steady way of making money for studios. That's all really kind of being challenged right now.
Well, in this gazillion channel universe, how much difference does it really make who's on top of the studio then?
You're seeing in both cases of Universal and Disney, you saw people that were tapped for these jobs have very strong backgrounds and success rates in branding, in taking a property. It's particularly important for Disney is to take a property and have it not just live and be successful at the box office, but work on television and home video and inspire spinoffs. And again, for Disney, T-shirts and lunchboxes and keychains and perhaps even its own online realm.
So you got to sell, baby, sell, right?
When it works for them, like a Hannah Montana or, you know, Wizards of Waverly Place, which is becoming their buzz bin hit, the star of that show is Selena Gomez. She's a singer and she has her own line of clothing. You know, you can see her, probably she'll graduate to movies at some point. I mean, that's the kind of franchise grooming that the executive Rich Ross, who was just named head of the studio, was known for. And that's the kind of business that Disney is looking at. It's not so much the old business of let's put Denzel Washington and Julia Roberts into a movie.
Is that because Denzel Washington and Julia Roberts can't really open a movie anymore, to use the lingo, or is it just the studios realize they need other revenue streams?
It's a mixture of both, but there's no question for the big Hollywood studios, the kind of traditional adult-oriented dramas and star vehicles are challenged right now. People are thinking twice before committing $150 million to a caper thriller these days.
Cynthia Littleton at Daily Variety, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Wall Street was pretty entertaining today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Over in the UK, an icon of British publishing marks a major anniversary this week. The society magazine Tatler has been charting the ups and downs of London's upper classes on and off for 300 years. 2009 and 2008 and 2007 and so on have been tough years for established print media, but not apparently for Tatler, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard explains.
At 85,000, the circulation has dipped a little. Ad revenue is slightly down too. But otherwise, Tatler's in great shape, says editor Catherine Osler. The secret? A readership that occupies the ultimate niche, the wealthy and the well-connected.
The magazine is about much more than the traditional upper classes. It's about kind of old money, new money, and sort of powerful people.
She says the magazine is beautifully written and stunningly illustrated with glossy photographs. But Ben Fenton of the Financial Times says the real attraction lies in the party pages, page after page of snaps taken at society gatherings.
And they put loads of photographs and names of people in. It's a well-recognised model for local newspapers, and it obviously works just as well for the upper crust.
The magazine proved such a hit with Russian oligarchs and their hangers-on in London that Tatler's now launched a Russian edition in Moscow. It sells 70,000 a month. Oddly enough, the British edition sells quite briskly in New York, says editor Catherine Ostler.
Probably in America there's a certain fascination with what the English are up to.
American readers will need to have a keen interest in the British aristocracy to enjoy this week's commemorative edition. In a special photo shoot, Tatler features the largest number of dukes assembled in one room since the coronation of the Queen. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Here's a quick news item by way of introduction to our next story. New York City, as you may know, has a law that says restaurants have to post the calorie content for each item on their menus, on the theory that that's going to encourage people to order healthier meals. Well, some research out today shows that theory has some flaws in it, like people don't actually make better choices. Even with the calorie count posted, diners picked meals that were worse for them. Little white lies to ourselves to make it easier to order the Big Mac, I suppose. Behavioral economist Dan Ariely is back with us talking about a different set of white lies and what they might say about the way we do business. Dan, good to have you here again.
Nice to be here.
I hate to say this, but we're back to one of your favorite subjects, cheating.
Well, you don't need to call it my favorite topic, but definitely something I'm interested in.
Well, all right. Well, do tell here. You've got golf and cheating. Is that the score?
I thought about golf and cheating because it looked to me like golf is something that actually could teach us something about the business world. And think about it. Golf is a team effort. I mean, you play with other people, but it's also an individual endeavor. Everybody basically gets to control themselves and decide what rules to follow and what rules not to follow. And golf, much like accounting and other things, have lots and lots of rules. So I was curious about what people cheat in golf and how much they cheat.
All right. Well, first, let me preface this by saying we will get emails from many, many golfers who say that the joy and the glory of that sport is that golfers follow the rules. They are honorable, law-abiding people who never, ever cheat. And that's the principle of the game.
I'm sure you'll get calls like this. But nevertheless, we got a golf company to help us out, and they send emails to their users, and we got about 17,000 people to respond. And first of all, as you would expect, they admitted to cheat less than they thought other people cheat.
Right.
And it was curious to see the patterns of cheating. So first of all, there's something called a mulligan. And a mulligan is the idea that you hit the first shot and it doesn't work very well, and you get a do-over, as the kids say, right? You start again.
Yep.
And what's interesting is that people feel very good about taking a mulligan on the first hole of the day. They don't feel very good about taking it on the ninth hole. Another interesting thing that we find is that people have a relatively easy time writing on their scorecard a different number than the number of strokes they really took.
Yeah, because nobody's watching.
But once they write this number down, they have a harder time adding it up wrongly.
Right. So it's easier to cheat in the moment then.
It's easier to cheat in the moment, and it's easier to cheat when there's like no traces for this cheating.
These 17,000 people, Dan, did they list occupation when they responded to this survey? Do we know, you know, how the accountants did and how the doctors did?
We do know how they did. First of all, it turns out that people in the pharmaceutical industry cheated a lot, but they also said that their industry is the most honest that there is. There's some other interesting comparisons. For example, if you look at law enforcement, education, and government, people in those three industries basically cheat on average, as do people in sales, marketing, advertising, and so on. But the people in law enforcement, education, and government think that they are the most honest, while the people in sales and marketing and advertising cheat just the same, but they think that they come from industries that are much less honest.
Bring this back to the workplace for me, Dan. What does this tell us about the way things get done in this country and how we actually do and manage our economy?
So first of all, I think the cheating in golf is kind of a good example for how we think about day-to-day tasks. The fact that people can take a mulligan or how they can cheat on golf, I think tells us that there's a lot of corner bending that we see in the business world. And what I worry about is that once we start on this path of immorality, even with small bending of rules and cutting corner here and there, that this tendency could become bigger and bigger and really a part of the collective understanding of how business is actually done.
Dan Ariely teaches behavioral economics at Duke University. His book is called Predictably Irrational. Dan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Hey, Dan, wait, before I let you go, who is the most honest? Do we know that?
Well, the most honest, quite surprisingly, were the people from the insurance industry.
Really?
Could you believe it? Yeah. Yeah, they cheated. It turns out that they thought that they were not particularly honest as an industry, but in our sample, they cheated the least.
So maybe, what does that tell you?
Well, it tells me I'm having a renewed belief in my insurance agent right now. Or maybe it tells us that the people who from AIG have left the market and are not playing golf right now.
Oh, man. Oh, my goodness.
That's cruel.
Coming up, one of the original stimulus plans.
If you applied to a college and you were accepted, the government would pay your tuition at any school in America, no matter how elite or how expensive it was.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up 131 points today, about 1.33%, closed at 97.31. The NASDAQ rose 35 points, 1.7%, ended at 21.03. The S&P 500 added 14 points, almost 1.33% there as well, finished at 1,054. Australia bumped up its interest rates. That took the shine off the dollar and put it on gold and other metals. Newmont Mining, the biggest U.S. gold producer, polished up nearly 7% today. Aluminum giant Alcoa climbed 3.5%. Corning picked up 4.67% today. Analysts upgraded the world's biggest maker of glass for liquid crystal display panels. The price fell on the 10-year T-note. That nudged the yield up to 3.26%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Wednesday. The Federal Reserve Board releases its August report on consumer credit. President Obama will host a star party to celebrate Galileo's first use of the telescope 400 years ago. A group of middle school children will stargaze with the first family on the White House lawn. And on this day, 8 years ago, the U.S. went to war with Afghanistan. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We're going to jump right into letters this week by talking about the good old U.S. of A. A couple of weeks ago, commentator Dan Dresner had some unkind things to say about the Obama administration's trade policies, specifically those 35% tire tariffs the president imposed on China late on a Friday night. Dan said that's no way to build an economic recovery. Protectionism, he called it. That struck a chord with Larry Tagrin from Montgomery County, Maryland.
I also shout protectionism, but in my case, I shout for protectionism. What's wrong with protecting American companies, American workers, and America's industrial base?
Commentator and former venture capitalist Andy Kessler weighed in on how to write new rules for Wall Street. What he said, actually, was that Wall Street is a dangerous place where you can lose your job in the blink of an eye, and so the salaries there are basically like combat pay. Navy veteran Ralph Staples from San Diego, California, has a different perspective.
I find any comparison between bonuses and combat pay to be completely misplaced. In the risk versus reward trade-off, on Wall Street, if I don't perform, I may not get a bonus or be fired. In combat, the risk is much, much higher. It is your life, loss of limbs, or mental and emotional stability at stake.
Last week, Jennifer Collins brought back a story about how corruption in Kenya is making the drought there far worse. That prompted a lot of you to write, including Joshua Tuku, a Kenyan living here in the United States.
Corruption is the key ingredient to the overall problem, though lack of rainfall for prolonged periods of time does not help the situation. No one in power seems to care about these souls. My heart goes to them. These are my brothers and sisters we are talking about, literally.
There was a lot of interest in how to help the people profiled in that story. We've got some links on our website. It's marketplace.org/Kenya. Finally, last week we had Jim Davis on from the talent management firm DDI about his company's survey on job satisfaction. A lot of people said their careers are stuck in a rut, but at the same time, some of them admitted to playing hooky and surfing the web instead of, you know, working harder and trying new things. Davis said he was surprised by that in a recession. Emma Stockwell from Sunnyvale, California, wonders why the surprise.
I think that people are truly depressed about the future. Why try when you know you'll be next on the chopping block? Why try when you have to take on even more work, when already overworked from laid-off colleagues? The job market, when added to everything else, is enough to make people give up.
A lot of the letters we get are about the music on the program. We've got a list of all the day's songs and a feature called Recession Rocks, music to liven up your downturn. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Also there, that link that says contact. The government says about 300,000 veterans are expected to go to college this year, with the GI Bill helping to pay at least part of the cost for housing, books, and tuition. While the current version encourages veterans of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq to get a college degree, the GI Bill is hardly a new idea. It dates back to the Second World War, when returning vets got a higher education, basically for free. Stephen Smith from American Radio Works reports the first GI Bill not only changed how Americans go to school, it transformed the economy in the process.
When World War II ended in 1945, America faced an ominous problem: how to settle its war veterans back into civilian life. In wars dating back to the Revolution, American vets got few benefits after the fighting stopped. But in World War II, the scale of the problem was huge. 16 million Americans.
One-eighth of the population, one out of eight Americans, were serving in some capacity during the war.
Historian Ed Humes.
You can't have that number of men and women treated shabbily because the country would fall apart. It could never withstand it.
As World War II came to a close, many feared a return of the Great Depression, which had gripped the nation for more than a decade before the war began. So in 1944, Washington passed a sweeping set of benefits known as the GI Bill of Rights. Vets got unemployment checks, low-interest housing and business loans, and...
If you applied to a college and you were accepted, the government would pay your tuition at any school in America, no matter how elite or how expensive it was.
The government was surprised by how many GIs took advantage of the education benefit, nearly 8 million veterans in all. Management guru Peter Drucker said that providing free higher education to so many Americans changed the world by creating the modern knowledge economy. Historian Ed Humes agrees.
The scientists and engineers and teachers and thinkers who brought in the information age, who took us to the moon, who waged the Cold War, you name it, all those men and women were educated through the GI Bill.
When I came back from 2.5 years with the United States Marine Corps in World War II, I decided that I wanted to go on to graduate school.
MIT was the place that Captain George Shultz wanted to study economics.
And sure enough, I got my tuition paid, and I got a little tiny stipend to go with it.
The greatest invasion in all history.
A million veterans pouring onto the college campuses of America, from Harvard to Stanford, from State to Old Siwash.
This is a government newsreel from 1947. Before World War II, most Americans didn't have a high school diploma, much less a college degree. After the war, college enrollment exploded.
An academic crusade inspired by the GI Bill of Rights. There never was such a mass movement towards higher education. It's been called the greatest sociological experiment of all time.
But back in the mid-1940s, no one knew how this sociological experiment would really turn out. Historian Suzanne Mettler says some college officials fretted about whether combat-hardened veterans could fit in among teenage freshmen.
People like the president of the University of Chicago and the president of Harvard worried that this was going to make institutions of higher education into hobo jungles, as they put it, to bring in the riffraff.
Turns out the GIs had an altogether different effect on the once clubby bastions of college life. 25-year-old guys who'd stormed beaches in combat gear had no time for freshman beanies or raccoon coats. They were on a mission.
Some are working with grim concentration towards a degree or a job. They are defter, quicker because of wartime skills. They know how to tackle a job and get it done.
We were there strictly to learn something, and we were demanding.
Again, World War II veteran George Shultz.
I think it helped to raise the standards all across America. And now we have, without any question, the best system of higher education in the world.
Historians say the GI Bill fueled a major expansion of the nation's higher education system and made college a cornerstone of middle-class American life. Marine Captain George Shultz did pretty well with his GI Bill education. He taught at MIT in Chicago. He ran a big construction company. And George Shultz served as U.S. Secretary of State. Historian Ed Hume says the free education that so many veterans got under the GI Bill helped make the greatest generation so great.
The GI Bill provided the education for 14 Nobel Prize winners, 3 Supreme Court justices, 3 presidents, a dozen senators, 2 dozen Pulitzer Prize winners, 200...
And even though it's a bit of a trite saying, this list really does go on and on and on. This is Stephen Smith for Marketplace.
Of course, we can't forget the 22,000 dentists, 91,000 scientists, 67,000...
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, a scene from the Great Recession of 2008-2009. The 111-year-old Michelin man is getting a facelift and a Facebook page and a YouTube channel as well. Apparently, the company is trying to appeal to cost-conscious consumers. I always thought it was a branding problem myself. I always thought that tire guy looks entirely too much like the Pillsbury Doughboy. I don't know. Maybe that's just me. Anyway, that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained 131 points, about 1.33%. The NASDAQ rose 35 points, 1.7%. The S&P 500 added 14 points, almost 1.33% there. Thanks today to Jennifer Collins on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this broadcast, when the Berlin Wall fell, East German companies crumbled too.
All the people out there were keen to wear Western brands, and they lost their sports market as well. And so all of a sudden, they lost everything they had.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.